Welcome. Thanks for joining us today on the Venture Podcast. We hope this message encourages you and inspires you along your journey.
Well, good morning, Venture. Man, it's great to be with everyone, and I want to add to what was said earlier, just my thanks for an incredible Easter weekend. Just thousands who came from all the services and just to be able to celebrate together. And so thank you for so many of you who served, who were a part of that. Had great celebration here. And we're excited this weekend. I'm excited to welcome those in the classic service, those who are watched online. As we're going to do something a little bit different, we're going to take a break from the book of Acts. If you're part of the Venture family, we spend most of our time teaching through a book of the Bible, teaching through it, but it's good time to time to stop and just look at different topics. And this one, we're looking at it just kind of differently, even in the premise of it, of I can't believe that. You might be here and you go, I thought church was all built on what we do believe. But I think it's good from time to time to step back and go, why do we believe what we believe? And maybe somebody struggles with believing it. If you're here today and maybe you're skeptical on some of the topics, in fact, you saw it on the card, but topics we're going to cover over the next 6 weeks with this, of whether there's a God or whether you can believe Jesus is really God or why would you believe the Bible. If you're here and you're a skeptic, thank you for coming. There's good cause for skepticism. We live in a world where, I don't know about you, I get pretty skeptical. But there's some things worth at least investigating. I love how Tim Keller puts it. He said, you know, if you got a letter in the mail today, and it's from a law firm, and they told you that a long-lost relative had left you $1 million. Now, I don't know about you, my first response would be very skeptical. In fact, I'd be looking for their angle. How are they trying to make money off of me on this? Because this is some kind of scam, especially in the world we live in. And it may be, but at the very least, for $1 million, I bet you'd check it out. You'd at least investigate. Is this a real law firm? You'd call, you'd find out about it. Some things are worth investigating. And that's what I would say on all these topics. You may come in very skeptical. At the very least, don't you owe it to yourself to investigate it? Now, as we dive into it, I'll just tell you in the outset, I'm working off of some assumptions. Anytime you talk about subjects like this. And so I've got some assumptions that I've built in. The first one is there are no silver bullets, that one aha moment that proves the point beyond any doubt. I don't have them in any of the messages. There's no like one silver bullet, that moment, because sometimes you can kind of set it up as a speaker in that way with it, and you make it really look, but I don't have any, you know, Colonel Mustard in the library with the candlestick. Ha ha, I've proved it. It's not there. But I think there's evidence that reasonable people can wrestle with and may disagree about. In fact, my second assumption is smart people can disagree. Smart people can disagree. And they do on these issues. I don't think it's just an issue of smarts. And again, I say that because sometimes, you know, church, we're talking about these issues, and obviously I'm going to talk about them from a Christian perspective. This is home court for us. And we can almost present it in this way that, oh man, only the smartest people would believe this. Now, as soon as you go out there, it flips completely. Culture totally switches it. I love the way Mark Clark, he said, how often have we turned on the television and heard the host say, tonight we will be talking about faith versus science. Our first guest is a former University of Oxford professor, evolutionary biologist, and best-selling author. He believes that science, not faith, holds the answers to all questions. On the other side of the aisle, we have John Smith, who will speak for the legitimacy of faith in Christianity. John homeschools his kids, thinks Oprah is the Antichrist, and he lives in a swamp. Have you ever seen that? And you're like, oh, this isn't going to go well with it. Now, I would just say in this, and I have to just make an apology in one way out of the gate, because of the depth of some of the topics we're talking about, especially today. Man, we'll just hit the top of the surface of it. And I don't even pretend to act like I'm an intellectual in any of these categories we're talking about. But I love reading them and studying them. And I love that there are intellectuals throughout history who've embraced a Christian position. And you go all the way back from an Aquinas to a Pascal. I love the writing of C.S. Lewis. In modern times, a John Polkinghorne or Nicholas Wolstersdorf or Alvin Plantinga. In fact, you know, there's a complaint in secular universities. They call it the Plantinga effect. He's a professor of philosophy. He was at Calvin and then Notre Dame. Strong Christian. He's had such an influence in philosophy that all these secular universities are going, man, the Plantinga effect means there's so many Christian philosophers who are teaching in it. There's people all across the spectrum, from a Francis Collins to a William Lane Craig. There are intellectuals that if you're here today and you go, man, I would like to go deep on some of these subjects, I promise you there are people to meet you in that. Final assumption is that the Christian position requires faith, but it's a reasonable faith. It requires faith. And I say that to Christians, because sometimes we get into apologetics in these things, and we so want to build it in a way that we go, oh man, it can all just be built rationally, when Scripture has said all along, faith is a core part of what we believe. Hebrews says it this way, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen, that we're convicted about things we can't see. And the reality is God could have set up his system in a way that it didn't require faith. If you believe in the Christian God, he's not lacking for the ability to prove himself. And we would say he has throughout history. He's given proofs. But by design, guys, he wanted faith to be a part. I mean, our core verses we celebrate, for by grace you've been saved through faith. It's not your own doing. It's a gift of God. The faith itself is a gift from God. It's not the result of our works, not a result of our intelligence, not a result of anything else, so that none of us can boast. And so I just say that if you're coming in as a skeptic, you're gonna see several places where our system, what we believe, it requires faith. I assume that, believe that. But I don't believe it's a blind faith, because sometimes it's put in those terms of, well, if it's faith, we just close our eyes and we jump and Jesus catch me, hope it's good. And yet if you look through history, you look through the writings of people, you look through the arguments that have been put forward, you'll find it's a reasonable faith. It's not a blind leap, but it will always require a step of faith. Especially as we talk about the topic today, I wanna walk through something as big as just, could you even believe there is a God? Now, for some of you, you go, yes, it's absolutely. Hopefully this emphasizes what you believe. And maybe you're here and you go, yeah, Tim, I struggle. I'm agnostic at best. Maybe there is, but you can never know him. I think there's some evidences, and we're just gonna hit some of those evidences, pointers. Every one of these points could be a lecture. Every one of these points, people have written on them and they go deeper with it. But I want to give us just a survey of why would you ever believe there is God? Immanuel Kant, the great philosopher, he kind of put it in two categories. He said, if you're going to boil it down, it's the stars and it's what's inside. The morals and then stars and the categories. And so first four categories we're looking out there. Last three categories we'll look internal with it. First evidence, I would say, is the existence of the universe itself. The existence of the universe. The law of causality in the universe tells us if you have an effect, there was a cause for it. When you come along, you see something. I mean, I see the piano here. I assume somebody moved it out here. I assume there's a reason. I don't ever look at something and go, oh, that just happened in it. And so for the universe, if we look at it and we go, okay, we got all this around us. The universe is there. It's the effect. It's there. What caused it? And for Christians, you go right to the beginning of the Bible, we have in the beginning, God. So we would say God is the one who caused everything after. And so he's the as Aquinas would call him, he's the great uncaused cause. Nothing caused him, but he caused everything that follows with that. Now, if you're here as a skeptic, you go, yeah, but you can't prove that. You can't scientifically. I can't, but I would ask you then, what is the cause for the effect that you see in the universe? What would you put in it? In the beginning, blank. What do you put there? What put it in motion with it? And for many years, even centuries, kind of what was put there was, well, the universe is eternal. You guys have an eternal God. We don't need an eternal God. The universe has just always been here. And that held up till about 1929 when Edwin Hubble looked through a telescope and he looked at it and he was able to document, wait a second, the universe is expanding. And it's expanding. If it's expanding at the rate it's expanding, what's going on? They could trace it back that it actually had a starting point. That's described as Big Bang and traced back to about 14 billion years ago. And you may be here today and you go, I don't believe in Big Bang. I don't believe it was that long ago. I'm not debating when. Hey, here's the only point I point out, that it's universally accepted there was a starting point of the universe. So if there's a starting point, what started it? If it's not eternal, there had to be something there that caused it. And even those who wrestle with it, in fact, I'll show you a number of quotes. I tried to pick people who don't agree with our position from the other side. You can see a quote from Alexander Vilenkin. He's a professor of evolutionary science. He heads the Cosmology Institute at Tufts University. Cosmology is, where did the cosmos, where did the universe come from? These questions. Look at his quote. He says, with the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a post-eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. You gotta have to say, you can't just say it came out of nothing. We don't have any other case where we would look at it and go, well, we now have something and it came from nothing. No one would ever agree to that, except in the one case of the universe at the very beginning. As you wrestle with evolutionary cosmologists, those who are atheistic in it, have to wrestle with this point of, well, we don't know what it came from, but the universe appeared. Richard Dawkins wrote The God Delusion. He's probably the most popular atheist speaker. You see him on TV shows. He's usually the ones in the debate. Very winsome guy, very bright in that. Dawkins said, of course, it's counterintuitive that you can get something from nothing. Of course, common sense doesn't allow you to get something from nothing. That's why it's interesting. It's got to be interesting in order to give rise to a universe at all. Something pretty mysterious had to give rise to the origin of the universe. Now, I don't know about you. I look at it, it's counterintuitive. It's interesting. Something mysterious. This sounds a lot like faith, doesn't it? Like, can't describe it, don't know what did it, how it happened. Now, Dawkins would say, yeah, I have faith, we'll discover what did it one day. It's just for the Christian, what we would say, Hebrews 11, by faith, we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. This is our common, our starting point in the beginning, God. And there's a lot of debate among Christians about how that unfolded, the timing, all that. I don't want to even argue that. I just want to go, for Christians, we just step back and we go, we believe God is the uncaused cause. And we recognize it takes faith to believe that. But I would say it also takes faith to hold to a system that something came from nothing and we don't know how, it's just a mystery. There's some faith involved in that as well. Second evidence, the presence of life. How did life even come forth? The law of biogenesis in the material universe, in our physical universe here, life arises from previously existing life of its own kind. Life comes from life. Pasteur was able to produce, or was able to prove that spontaneous generation, that life can just spontaneously generate, it doesn't work. And so he disproved that. And so out of that, you look and you go, okay, well, how did life, even if you suddenly somehow out of nowhere got this material universe, how did life come out of it? How do you come from this matter that suddenly springs into life? And I don't know if you remember the textbook, if you were taught when you were in school, the famous experiment by Stanley Miller back in 1953. And he based on his mentor, Harold Urey's work, they recreated in a lab what they considered the atmosphere of the early Earth, early time period, and they shot electricity through it, and out of that were able to produce some beginning amino acids, the building blocks for it. And it's like touted as like, oh, that proved it. The problem is, since Miller's time, those who've come and they've looked at it and they said, yeah, the gases they used to mimic early Earth were not the gases that were actually here. You can't just put this together because I'm able to accomplish that. Jonathan Wells with the Discovery Institute, did all of his doctoral work at Berkeley, by the way. Wells, as he studied it, he said the experiment cannot produce the right substrate for life. He said, and if you want to create life on top of the challenge of somehow generating the cellular components out of non-living chemicals, you'd have an even bigger problem in trying to put the ingredients together the right way. Even if you were to somehow generate those, that you line them up in the right way, that you suddenly had life. He said it's beyond reason for him. As you look at it, you know, John Sullivan said, so as far as the actual evidence goes, biogenesis is still the only possible conclusion. Sullivan, by the way, he's an evolutionary atheist. He does not believe in the Christian position, but he said, it's a conclusion that seems to lead back to some supernatural creative act. Now he has to say seems, because he's already said there is no supernatural creative act. He's said God doesn't exist, even though the evidence seems to point to that. And so in his mind, you go, well, we have to keep looking for it. Anthony Flew, somebody, and I'd encourage you to read on Anthony Flew. For 50 years, he was one of the leading atheists in the world. He wrote many works with it. And at the turn of the 21st century, Flew came forward with this just radical declaration that he actually believed there was a God. He said in it, the only satisfactory evidence for the origin of such indirected, self-replicating life as we see on Earth is an infinitely intelligent mind. And people were shocked when Flew made the admission, when he published it. I think he put his first publishing on an Easter morning in the London Times. People were shocked by it. How could Flew change his mind? And part of it, he just said, look, I've always told you guys, I'm someone who I chase the evidence to its end. And there's undeniable evidence when I look at life and it's actually self-replicating, it has DNA, it has a code in it. I see a coder that has to be a part of that. It's hard for me to deny that. Look at the third evidence, the fine-tuning of the universe to support life, the fine-tuning of the universe. Keller calls it God's welcome mat, or the welcome mat of the universe, of how it was so infinitely fine-tuned that it actually works. One scholar said, you've got to take all the laws of physics, and he narrowed it down to, he said, it's like having 122 different dials that are all dialed to the exact place they need to be for life to work. And everyone embraces the odds against us having the universe we have are unbelievable. No matter how you would start, especially if you take God out of it. Just to give you the odds, the chance of our universe coming into existence is about 10 to the 138th. That's 10 with 138 zeros behind it. That's the chance of it. Based on all the laws of physics, which by the way, they don't know who created the laws to begin with. Even Richard Dawkins has said that when he's asked about it, well, didn't the laws have to be in place before the physical could respond to it? And he said, yeah. He said, physics still needs its Darwin. In other words, there's nobody in physics that explained yet how this could come to be out of it. 10 to 138, give you some idea of how that compares. The number of seconds in human history in the entire universe is 10 to the 17th. The number of atoms in the universe is 10 to the 70th. But we believe by chance that 10 to the 138th, it happened. It was that fine-tuned, could make life happen. I mean, when I see that, and again, it's a crude illustration, but I can't help but think of, you know, Jim Carrey, when he's in Dumb and Dumber and he looks at the girl, and he says, what's the chance of a girl like you and a guy like us, me getting together? And she said, not good. And he says, how not good? Like one in 100? And she goes, like one in a million. And then he smiles at her and says, so you're saying there's a chance. And there's a part of it here that everyone by admission has to say is unbelievable odds this was fine-tuned to this level. But we are here, so we just embrace that. I mean, that's why you've got a guy like Paul Davies, he's Australian. He says, our universe seems just right for life. It looks as if a super intellect has been monkeying with the physics. It looks as if that way. Now, I don't believe in a super intellect, so it can't be that. But it looks that way. Michael Schumer, the editor of and founder of Skeptic Magazine, he says, the reason people think that a designer created the world is because it looks designed. Okay. Or Stephen Hawking, again, one of the greatest minds of our time, he said, here's just one example of how it could go wrong. If the rate of expansion 1 second after the Big Bang Theory had been smaller by even one part in 1,000 million millionths, the universe would have recollapsed before it ever reached its present size into a hot fireball. The odds against a universe like ours emerging out of something like the Big Bang are enormous. And then he kind of puts this, I think there are religious implications. This is bigger than us. And again, on all these, as we look at the evidence around it, I don't have this slam dunk proof, but there's enough here that makes me go, well, isn't that worth questioning? Romans says this way, he says, God's invisible attributes, namely his eternal power, his divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world. He said, yeah, God put this out there because he wants to tell this about himself. He wants us to ask these questions. They've been there since all things have been made, so they're without excuse. So that everybody looking at it would have to look at it and go, wait, does this add up in it? Let me give you the fourth one, the mysteries of the universe. And I have to be careful with mysteries because today's mysteries in the universe can be tomorrow's discoveries. And so I recognize that. But it is fascinating to me in a universe where we make these unequivocal assumptions and declarations with it, how much we don't know. I mean, just even the discovery of dark energy and dark matter, of looking out and you go, well, what is that? Well, here's how NASA describes what is dark energy. More is unknown than known. We know how much dark energy there is, because how it affects the universe expansion. So they've looked at the expansion, they go, this doesn't work unless there's something else there. And they've computed its dark energy. Other than that, it's a complete mystery. This is from NASA, by the way. It was out there, but it's a mystery. It's an important mystery. It turns out that roughly 68% of the universe is dark energy. Well, that's a lot. And dark matter makes up about 27%. You say, what's dark matter? National Geographic did an article on it. Dark matter is completely invisible to light and other forms of electromagnetic radiation, making dark matter impossible to detect with any of our current instruments. So we can't see it and we can't detect it. We know it's there, and between dark energy and dark matter, it's 95% of the universe. Now, again, this doesn't prove or disprove. But isn't it enough to just step back and go, okay, if by our estimation, we only have 5% that we can actually see, wouldn't it at least open a question? That maybe there's more we don't know before we just X out a whole category that we can't prove? That's the external, what Kant called the starry. He then turned, he said, now what about the internal proofs? And Kant would say this is the strongest proof of God. Humanity's sense of morality and justice. Humanity's sense, the sense that we have that there's morality, that there's justice out of that. Look at the paleontologist, Gaylord Simpton. He's probably the most famous paleontologist of the 20th century. He says, good and evil, right and wrong, concepts irrelevant in nature except from the human viewpoint. They become real and pressing features of the whole cosmos as viewed morally, because morals only arise in humans. Now, why did they though? I mean, if we are just on a stratum. If we're on a continuum from the rocks and the slime up to the animals, and we don't hold animals to the same moral code that we have. We would never look and go, that's an evil rock. We don't look at a dog that steals another dog's bone and go, thief. How dare. We don't prosecute killer whales because they're killers. It's just a name in it. And so the question, C.S. Lewis brings, the question arises, where did this code of right and wrong come from? And as Lewis describes it, it's pretty fascinating. Lewis would say, look at anybody arguing. Look at any child in an argument. People that are arguing, you will not hear someone say, hey, that is mine, and so I'm bigger than you, so I get to take it. You're in my seat. Oh, I'm bigger than you. I get to take it. Hopefully you didn't do that to somebody coming in. You know, you walked in and they're sitting in your seat because you sit in the exact same seats every week, which most of you do, by the way. Throws me off every so often. You'll sit in a different seat and I'm like, oh, I wonder why they're over there. Oh, they're in the back. Oh, I bet they got to leave early today. Something it always goes through my mind with it on that. Now what does Lewis say? We don't do it based on might or the other things. What do we say? That's wrong. That's not fair. It's not your turn. All of us have this standard of what is right and wrong internally from childhood. And the question Lewis would ask and Kant would ask and others would say, where does that code come from in an evolutionary system when what we came from doesn't have that code? Now, some would say as we evolved into a morality, and yet the morality that we would hold doesn't really even match the system. I mean, if you're building a system on survival of the fittest, shouldn't the strongest and fittest be allowed to take what's best for their own, for the survival of mine? I mean, people that have built on those theories have come up with some pretty horrendous practices. Even the name of Darwin's original book, we call it The Origin of Species. The whole name of it is actually On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle of Life. There's a reason why in England and in this country and around the world, eugenics as a policy was very favored in the last century, especially between World War I and World War II, where people said there are favored races, there are favored people that we should breed. And you look at it, probably the most horrific example of that played out would be with Hitler. And so as you look at that, you go, yeah, how did a moral standard that today none of us would hold to that, I would hope, and we fight against it, and we would go, that's horrific, that's immoral, would be the words that we would use. And I would agree, it's absolutely immoral. But on what basis? There's a guy named Peter Singer. He taught at Princeton. He's a bioethicist, taught for years. Mild-mannered guy, if you saw him, you know, you wouldn't think much. Actually teaches horrific principles. Because Singer just chased out and he said, okay, there's not a God. We've got to build a new morality based on the continuum of who we are in the animal species. And so Singer and his colleague, listen to this, he doesn't hesitate to advocate for the killing of infants after they're born. He writes, he says, my colleagues Helga Kunze and I, we suggest that a period of 28 days after birth might be allowed before an infant is accepted as having the same right to life as others. Singer argues that pigs and chickens and fish have more signs of consciousness and rationality. They've got greater claims to rights than a newborn does. Or, by the way, people with mental disabilities. He also says they don't have the same rights as those animals. And part of what he's basing his work on, you go back to Nietzsche said this. When Nietzsche said, God is dead, the myth of the past, the morality that was built on a God has to be rebuilt. And Nietzsche said it would be good for culture to hold on to that morality if they can, even based on the myth, Otherwise, it falls into the abyss. But you take core human principles that every person has dignity and life. As Nietzsche pointed out, yet that root is built on, though, a belief system in a God, that people have dignity because they were created in the image of God. And all Singer is doing is he's coming along, he goes, hey, if we're gonna actually erase that whole system and rebuild, he says, I can build a very logical system that calls for things that are actually pretty horrific. You know, it's interesting. There's a gentleman, he teaches down in Florida. He grew up here in the peninsula, Chris Gabbard. I went to Stanford, was educated here. And he was very influenced by Peter Singer's writings. Even as a professor in it, he said there's a consistency to what he wrote. He said, I always grew up prizing intellectual aptitude. I detested poor mental functioning. I believed with him that severely disabled people should be allowed to die. He believed that until there was an accident during the birth of his son. And his son, who suffered a brain injury, he's a quadriplegic, he has cerebral palsy. As Gabbard talked about, he said, after his birth, I was deeply ambivalent. I've been persuaded by Singer's advocacy of infanticide, but there was my son asleep or unconscious on a ventilator, motionless, under a heat lamp, tubes and wires and everything, monitors alongside his steel and transparent plastic crib. He said, what stirred me most was the way he resembled me. Nothing had prepared me for this shock. He was almost like he was the image of me when I was an infant. And he turned. And now Chris Gabbard is one of the strongest advocates for the inherent dignity of every life. He's one of the strongest advocates for children, not just his kids, for every person in it. When faced with a reality like that, you suddenly look at it and go, yeah, what is my morality built on? Now hear me. Let me make sure I'm really clear. I am not saying, oh, every atheist is like Peter Singer. In fact, Richard Dawkins, others, boy, they want to separate from him. Richard Dawkins, even though he writes The God Delusion and he's probably the most vocal atheist, he would call himself a cultural Christian. He says, I like cultural Christianity. I think it teaches good things. The problem I have, though, is what is it based on? What are you rooting that in? Again, Paul says that all humans show the work of the laws written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness. Their conflicting thoughts accuse or excuse them on the day when, according to the gospel, God judges the secrets of men by Jesus Christ. But Paul said this morality, this feeling we have, this instant thing that the smallest child will look at someone and go, that's wrong, this is right. Where do they get what code they have? It's written on their hearts. There is a standard. If you're gonna hold to moral standards, who's the standard bearer? For Christians, we would say it is God. Let me give you a couple more quickly and then we'll close out. This one, beauty and art and the connection to the soul. I don't have time to develop, but those who have written on the apologetics of aesthetics. G.K. Chesterton is one who points to it and he goes, if you look at beauty and pleasure in the world, does it not advocate for God? If you're gonna use suffering against him, can you use beauty for him? And who came up with those standards that we would agree on him? N.T. Wright says it this way. He says, we must acknowledge that beauty, whether in nature or in the natural order or within human creation, is sometimes so powerful that it evokes our deepest feelings of awe, wonder, gratitude, and reverence. It calls something out of us. That's why Psalm says, the heavens declare the glory of God. The sky above proclaims his handiwork. And then the final one I'd say as well, and again, I just say sacrificial love for the sake of others. How did that emerge? Where does that come from in a mechanistic system? And you'll read some that would say, yeah, it's for the survival of the species, that the chemicals within you, you feel the certain ways that you care for others, and that that's best for the survival of the species. But there's a part of me, and I just ask you, at a heart level, would you really reduce love to that? Just the chemicals that you feel? I was reading about a young woman, Jennifer Fulweiler, who grew up in a very rational home. Her parents believed that religion was just myth at best. In fact, she says as a young girl, their bedtime stories were Carl Sagan's Cosmos. They would read out of the book. I mean, she just grew up with that. That's how she believed in it. She was raised on a diet of science and reason. And then early in her marriage, she had a baby. One day she was looking at her little boy and she said, I had this dramatic shift. She said, I looked down and I thought, what is this baby? And I thought, well, from a pure atheist materialistic perspective, he's a randomly evolved collection of chemical reactions. And I realized if that's true, then all the love that I feel for him is nothing more than chemical reactions in my brain. And I looked down at him and I thought, that's not true. It's not the truth. There's more to us and there's more to love than it's just chemical reactions. You'd reduce your relationships to that? Again, the Bible gives us the great uncaused cause of love. God is love. And we experience it through him. And we experience it as creatures, even creatures that deny him, you experience, because as we would say, because you're created in his image. Love runs deep through all of us. Now, again, I know we've gone through evidence quickly. Let me just conclude with just a few thoughts with it. Why does this matter? Does it even matter if you believe in God? Well, one, belief in God has the potential to impact your well-being for the better. It actually has the impact your life with it. I read an article from Tanya Luhrmann. She's an anthropologist up at Stanford. And she wrote it, not writing as a Christian perspective per se, but just wrote the impact in culture and society and well-being and health of people who believe in God. Unbelievable results with it. I would say as well, belief in God has the potential to shape every facet of your life. It's not just religion, guys. And for those of us who have a deep belief in God, we'd love to discuss with you how it impacts how we see marriage, how we see our work, how we see ourselves. In a world where so many people, and especially so many young people, are struggling to believe that your life matters. I promise you this, it matters to God. And you will discover it in him in a way you can't discover otherwise. It matters because belief in God is the beginning to any relationship with him. If you want a relationship with him at all, it starts with that belief. It starts with a step. That's a step of faith. I understand that. Again, I'll go back to Hebrews 11. It says, without faith, it's impossible to please God. Without faith, you're not even gonna start this journey. For whoever would draw near to God, you gotta actually believe he exists. You're never gonna have a relationship with someone that you don't believe exists. You may have had your imaginary friend when you were growing up. Hopefully you outgrew it. And so if you're gonna have a revelation of God, you actually have to believe he exists. And look at that he rewards those who seek him. Those who are willing to just go, you know what, I will step out of my comfort zone. I'll step out of maybe even what I've built on. And I'll, at the very least, I'll seek him. And I'll just end with that. Don't you owe it to yourself enough to at least just seek if he's real? You know, Blaise Pascal was the famous mathematician, philosopher. He has this thing that he called, it was called Pascal's wager. And in it, he would say, make a bet that there's a God who loves you. Go ahead and just, if you would make the bet, here's his wager. If you're right, you have everything to gain. And he would say, if you're wrong, you have nothing to lose. Why don't you at least bet that he's real? If you're here today and you go, well, okay, how do I make a bet like this? Here's all I would ask you to do. And for a lot of you, it'd be very uncomfortable if you've never prayed before, if you've never taken a step at all. But here's all I'd ask. You don't have to do anything else other than maybe in your own heart. Would you seek, if there's a God enough, to just say this? God, if you're real, reveal yourself to me. Make yourself real. Is that too much? I mean, it's a pretty simple step. And I believe that he's a God who actually reveals himself. I believe over the next several weeks, and I know some of you go, yeah, but I can't believe in God because there's suffering and evil in the world. We'll talk about that next week. Let's just start today with that point. Could you, just if you're here today and you've never believed or maybe you've never really embraced, could you just say to him those words, God, if you're real, will you reveal yourself to me today? Let's pray together. Father, we thank you. We thank you for just the opportunity to come together. We thank you that you're so kind and gracious. We thank you that you designed this, that it requires faith. We know one day faith won't be needed anymore. Everything will be by sight. Everyone in the world will see you. But until that day, you've called us to have a real relationship with you. And so, Father, I pray if there's someone here and even the thought of talking to you is hard for them, would you give them the courage to make that step of seeking enough to ask you to reveal yourself? Lord, I thank you for what you've done in my life. I thank you for how you revealed yourself. I thank you for the greatest evidence of all, the life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen.
We hope today's message encouraged you in your journey of faith. To keep up with the latest messages and what's happening, make sure to subscribe to this podcast and visit venture.cc.